art is going to be, digital art can become really intimate, close to your eyes in a way that we haven't really thought about before. So I think that digital art is going to go into all sorts of different directions, and I'm pretty excited about it.
Alejandro, back on the podcast, season three. How we feeling?
Oh, man, I'm feeling so good, man. It should be a crime. You know, one of the things that I'm really just super excited about is, A, the Now Network has been crushing it, you know, and our newsletter has just been so incredibly growing. So thank you so much to the community. If you guys want to subscribe to the newsletter, please go to nftnow.com. Just get that newsletter. That's what I'm excited about. You know, that's what I'm saying it really is. Our community has been showing up in numbers with the Now Network and the newsletter. So I'm just super pumped about that.
Absolutely. It's been amazing to see that leaderboard, you know, just like a waterfall. I can't keep up, you know?
Yeah. And the tech behind it is going to be so amazing as well. Like, shout out to Aaron for building all those things out there. But Matt, who do we have on today, man?
Yeah, we got Sarah Mayojas. She's a conceptual artist and a pioneer, trailblazer in the intersection of cryptocurrency and art. Her Bitcoin project was ahead of its time, 2015. And she's continuing to push the envelope and conquer new conceptual territories with her work today. What excites you about the conversation?
Oh, man, what excites me about the conversation right now is that Sarah walked so that other artists could run. You know, and from that perspective, and I'm just really excited to find out where she comes from and where she's going, right? Like, we know so much of this window of time of her Bitcoin project, but what happened before, what happened after, that's really what I'm excited about.
There it is, you and me both. Without any further ado, let's talk to Sarah. Sarah, welcome to the NFT Now podcast. So happy to have you. How you doing?
Great, I'm happy to be here.
Oh, Sarah, this is such a special episode. I know you and I have crossed paths many years ago, many moons, and we've stayed in touch. But I'd love to just dive right in. Like, you know, you were one of the first people, if not the first artist, to put art on the Bitcoin blockchain. Like, tell us about that. Like, what was the idea? How did you come across it? And what was your thinking around this? And give us some context around that project.
Yeah, at the time I was in grad school. So I was in the School of Art at Yale, but I had just finished doing undergrad at Wharton in finance. And when I was at Yale, my work became very conceptual, mostly because I wasn't really a good craftsman physically, right? I hadn't gone to art school. And we had a format that was very much critique heavy, where you'd come in and you'd have to present kind of like a reality television show in front of five, you know, pretty famous artists. And it became clear that, like, my ideas and working with ideas as material was where I could excel, especially in the context of grad school, where you have no resources and where you have to make work in a really short period of time. And so when I started really digging into, okay, how can reality and ideas become a material for me to work with? Obviously, I circled around the idea of what is value, right? Because it was so, like, there was so much you could dig into. Art itself is a very interesting market. It is the market that is most divorced from the inputs, right, in terms of its value. It's you know, the most purely cultural market, and people talk about it and think about it, etc. And it's grown tremendously over the last 50 years in a way that wasn't the case before. So it's really grown into being a market. There was the fact that we live in a, you know, capitalist society, and the way that abstract system has very real physical consequences. And it's this fiction that we all adopt and that we kind of sort of take for granted now. And then it was And then it was going into theory and reading, like there was this one French philosopher who's not particularly well known, but Jean-Joseph Gou had written this book called Symbolic Economies that looks at political economy, but from this psycho, like this Lacanian psychoanalysis perspective, which is maybe not the right thing to do, but for the sake of like inspiration for art, it's perfect. And so that was, I was reading that and thinking about the nature of currency as a representation, like this, you know, currency, which bills, right, are very visual and are on this unique paper that you can't replicate, right? This issue of counterfeiting is very much real physically as well. So we talk about NFTs, but it's like physical dollar bills, hard to actually counterfeit. And so I was thinking about currency as this representation, as this thing that everything can be represented as. And then I heard about Bitcoin. And that's, and then suddenly I had done some other experiments about art and value, and they were all like, they all became
what
sort of.
What year was this? Just for context, like for
this
timeline
was
purposes.
2014 is when I heard about Bitcoin and decided that this was material for art.
Wow. I mean, you know, your work with Bitcoin, that project, you know, really made waves across the crypto space and beyond. Even back then, I remember when it first like crossed my path, well before this whole journey into the intersection of this technology and art. Tell us about the Bitcoin project, like, and the vision behind it.
Yeah, the vision behind it was that there was we'd gone through. Goodness, there's so many visions behind it. That's something I like
about
art.
What's your favorite one?
Is that there isn't just one. There has to be like multiple, so that it's a whole tangle of things that everybody has a different access point into getting sucked into it and then coming out a different way. So one of the visions was about being honest, about truth, of like the reality that when you're an artist and you're entering a market, you are creating your market, and that you are creating essentially like something that's like a currency, right? Warhol is a currency. There's always a Warhol traded somewhere, and they are, you know, comparable. So that art has aspects of currency. Damien Hirst is a currency. Of course, he later on did the actual currency, but he was doing that with his art, right? And so there's something about making something that at the time like sounded so ridiculous, but that's because like, but it was also just purely honest in giving people what they want, which is like a way to buy into your economic future, right? Because that's what people do with paintings, right? You buy a painter, and then their career goes up and their paintings appreciate. And so why not be honest about it and be like, you know what? You can buy Bitcoin, and Bitcoin is backed by my artwork. And so it both had like use value and exchange value and was itself a piece of art. So that was one thing about this sort of radical honesty. Two was like, I did really care about it being backed by something material, which is not how the NFT space then developed, but it was, there's something that appeals to me about being grounded in something real and having that counterpoint of something that's digital, like so-called immaterial, that can transact and get the benefits of transaction, but ultimately being backed by something that's very real. So that was something that I just instinctively gravitated to. And I'm not sure I have a strict philosophical reason for that, but I think it's just like my personality. I like having things be quite material. Yeah, I mean, as I've said, it was like an acceleration of trends. There was social media, people turning themselves into brands. What's the extreme of that? You turn yourself into a currency. There was this technology that was itself a creative act that was unbelievable, like breaking all systems. And that felt very inspiring, right? That this anonymous individual had created this new system of value. And that other people could too. So it felt like a creative act. It didn't feel like I'm starting a business. It felt like I'm creating, and I'm creating value.
I love that artist as currency like element. I'd love to dive deeper into that. But how did you get into the art world, first and foremost? How did you go from pen finance to what is considered one of the most world-renowned MFAs, if not the top MFA in art, right? What's that journey like? Did you grow up with art? Did you grow up with artists? Like, what was that thing that made you say, hey, how does Sarah Mejoyas become a currency in itself with art?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I grew up in New York, but my mother took me every weekend and without the intent of me becoming an artist, took me every weekend to museums. And she, my mom's French, and she had fallen in love with New York because of, you know, in the 90s, how vibrant a city it was and how much culture there was, and the museums are amazing. And so she is the one who gave me an artistic education every weekend. I was seeing everything. And then, but, you know, when I was in high school, I actually loved fashion, which, you know, makes sense. A teenage girl, as a teenage girl, I loved fashion, but I really loved haute couture. I really loved the most extravagant edge of fashion. You know, I remember when I was in high school, there was the Alexander McQueen show when he was still alive, where he had these robotic arms that were spray painting this white dress, and she looked like she was, you know, it was almost like it was a performance. It was looked like dance, practically, like a dance between all of them. And so those visions, those sort of dreams, that fantasy definitely appealed to me. But I was also quite academic and a good student, et cetera. And I went to business school undergrad, partly because I knew I wasn't sure what I wanted to do, but I figured for whatever I wanted to do, having a business education undergrad made sense. Partly, you know, my parents aren't American, and they didn't push me towards the liberal arts, right? In other countries, you know, my dad just went to law school. My mother studied pharmacy. You just study the thing. So I didn't totally, I was impatient, right? and I just wanted to learn something useful. And so I went to business school, and I liked math. And so finance and finances, I mean, I'm still, you know, still very much, there's one side of me that is always like an investor. And so I studied finance, and I started looking at, my dad wanted to give me, when I turned 18, a gift, but he didn't want to just give me money. Which had been, you know, a gift before, because I would just hoard it and not do anything with it. And so he wanted me to do something with it. And I thought long and hard. And so I said, okay, it could be seed money for me to buy an artwork. And it was in that context that I started not just going to museums, but going to galleries, which was different. And I started seeing things in galleries and thinking, I could do something like that. You know, like I could.
Why not me?
Right.
Me. Like this.
I could do that.
Yeah. But like this, you know, in this context, I could do that. And so then during college, you know, I took a photography class by chance. It then snowballed. I had some professors who really encouraged me, and I just went and I did wilder and wilder projects. And my work in college was very different than it is now, but was also like transgressive and looking for truth in a way. I was in my first, just to tell you how wacky I was then, I mean, in retrospect, like I'm, you know, but as a sophomore in college, in my first photography class, I decided to go and find and do these portraits of transgender people. This was in 2010. There was absolutely no conversation around identity, around trans rights. Never heard of such a thing, right? In 2010. And I went and I found, and it was also like a almost like experiment of pushing myself, because it was like, I was like a 19-year-old girl, like going and finding transgender people to connect with and like convince that, like, that they're safe in my hands for me to take a portrait of them. Right. And then the way I took the portraits of them was that we would have a conversation and we'd pick like a photograph of another, of like a beauty icon, right? Whether it's like Grace Kelly or Marilyn Monroe. And I would project that image onto their face, which is a very, you know, college thing to do, projection. And then they would fit into the features. We would align it as properly as possible. And that was the light that was creating the photograph. And so there are almost like two layers of transformation, right? There's their face, which was, you know, the people I met had like a lot of makeup and were very focused on how their face looked. There was a lot of construction. And then fitting into another face again, right? And so there are these, and that was my first art project, right? And then I continued doing, and that was, yeah, so that was, that was something that I now realize like kind of a wild thing to do. And then I did other projects in college where I had another student, a female student, pose nude in Huntsman Hall, wow, which went pretty, which was the Wharton building, and was, again, this, you know, she was nude, so in a sense, like exposed. But then she was wearing these like strong high heels, a little bit Helmut Newton. And so it really played with, you know, like who's in power here, right? And are you reclaiming power? Are you seducing? It's you know, playing with what the audience's expectations are. And that was my first brush with something going viral, because obviously it went viral on campus.
How did that make you feel? Like, you know, you were pushing boundaries, right? Like nude at Wharton, you're in college, you're doing photography, like, you know, you're bringing some elements of power, of seduction and truth. Like, how did that make you feel?
I think it made me feel like part of it too is being a young woman and like fine and like understanding what these things are about, how to like how identity is defined, like how to negotiate like your body in, you know, a male space, right? I was in classes with all men, right? Day to day. And so then it also, it felt like, yeah, I feel like I was like really investigating something and trying something. It felt very earnest, like, and so in a sense, like art is for like the different stages. Your art, like, is for like different stages of your life. But I definitely felt like this was, that I was onto something, that I liked creating images, that I liked creating stories through images, that I liked tangling up these different concepts till like something would hit, right? And so that's definitely that, yeah. And photography was the way in, because photography as art is necessarily conceptual. everybody takes photographs. They're, you know, ubiquitous. And so to claim that this photograph is art is to make a conceptual claim about it, right? Even though it's adopting the language of whether it's commercial photography or technical images or snapshots, right, of your family. All of these have different languages that you can play with when you're making photography as art. But photography as art is necessarily conceptual. And that's, you know, eventually that led to the other things.
I love that. I love that. It's so good to get like that insight into those early sort of forays. I'd love to hear about what your breakthrough was like. You know, like how do you think that you kind of took that forward, took all of that energy, that like spirit for experimentation and became, you know, one of the most sought out artists in the Web3 space?
So when I made Bitchcoin in 2014, 2015, and I put it out, it did have a moment online. People heard about it. It was an idea. It was circulating as an idea more than as, you know, the physical certificates. And so that was another great moment. I just remember because I was just sitting at Yale on my computer and suddenly people were really noticing this. And I, it was amazing. You know, it was like, I send in a little email to Wired and then they write about it, right? That for someone who's unknown, it did feel like a breakthrough moment. And then I did a series of projects in quick succession, right? I did the stock performance piece where I manipulated stocks and gestionally redrew them. Matt Levine wrote about that. And then I did Cloud of Petals, which was the, you know, the bridge with, you know, that we all know, Bitchcoin, Cloud of Petals. I did that project also in quick succession and another like intensive, right? This time a bigger scale. And then it felt like crickets. Mm-hmm. It felt like because remember that I was more in just the art world and the NFT world didn't really exist yet. And it felt like I was putting out things that I felt proud of, that I felt like I had given my all and I was happy with these pieces. And the issue was that the market wasn't really there for it. It was a bit there for the stock performance paintings because they were paintings. But Bitcoin, I didn't make anything off of that, right? I maybe broke even on my costs. And then Cloud of Petals, that was a 16 millimeter experimental film, all these pressed petals, like these light sculptures. I had no market other than speculation photographs, which were the way for people to access. And I had this amazing show and then it was just crickets. And it felt really bad. Like I moved to London.
Yeah. How did you feel about that?
Horrible. It just felt like confusing. You know, no one, you know, I approached like a gallery I'd shown with before about representation. Cause I was in this, it's funny, like I like to invest in deep tech and there's this like dead zone where, you know, you don't have like, you still need a bunch of money to get somewhere, but you can't really like sell yet. And I have projects that are expensive to do. And so it doesn't make sense for tiny galleries because they can't help with that cost and they can't sell for prices that will just cover the cost even. But then the top galleries aren't interested because it's not that commercial. And so for those projects, like, and even for the projects now, I mean, I am so emotionally driven to create work. I'm so not commercially driven. And my commercial side really comes in just as like a way to continue making this crazy stuff that I make. But so at that point, it was a real dead zone. I moved to London. I started writing a screenplay to make a movie. I worked on an augmented reality piece in HoloLens, but it was slow. Like it wasn't as quick as I had done the other projects. I was starting to look into technical glass, but and making a diffraction grating and so I was looking into other things, but it was just really slow. And then it was actually around the time, around 2021, that the NFT market came back, emerged. And I had separately still been just like plowing through creating new work and got into creating holograms. But again, with no market to speak of other than some photographs. And that's when things started coming together for me, because suddenly Bitcoin made me really like prescient, right? And I had all of this other work that just had been there. And then I also had this new body of work that I had been slowly getting towards, which was the holograms, that was a physical version of augmented reality meets stained glass. And that was the moment that I was able to like kind of lift off.
What motivated you through this period of no man's land? Like in deep tech, I'm also an investor in deep tech. Like I love like, you know, laser computing, VTOLs, things of that nature, right? Like you're absolutely correct. Like as an artist, what intrinsically motivated you to keep going, right? Because it could have been so easy to have been like, oh, that was just a moment. Thank you. I'm out. Or because you have an incredible collector base as well. Like you just, you're collected by some really prominent people. What was that psychology through that dark time?
I think that I had, it was a mix of, I had this belief, you know, you really have to believe. As an artist, you kind of oscillate between having an irrational belief in yourself and in art and in the power of art and in the beauty of art. And then also self-doubt, right? You have to be your biggest critic. When you're oscillating between those two things. And during that time, like I was definitely less productive too, because I wasn't giving myself the resources either. I'm someone who thrives on working with other people and with other people who are really good at certain parts of things. And I put things together and have vision to push them. And so during that time, I wasn't really giving myself the resources to push for things. But I knew that I wasn't giving that to myself, and I knew that I could do better. Like I knew that I had it in me, that I had made things that I was proud of, and that they were just simply not being recognized. Right? Like the first acquisition of my video piece was the Pompidou. No other collector acquired it before a museum acquired it. Right. So I knew that I like, you just have to have this crazy belief in yourself and know that you can perform at a level that you're not performing at currently.
Yeah, that's really powerful. And, you know, that segues really well into, I wanted to speak to that Pompidou acquisition, because I'm sure that that was really significant for you, given the period of hardship that led to Cloud of Petals, that led to some of the Bitcoin NFTs that were acquired. And I'm also curious, you know, we just broke the news of 10 autoglyphs being sold in like a landmark sale, 14.5 million. And those are going to be shown, in institutions, in museums. It was undertaken by a traditional art collector. And so I'm curious, like what you think that kind of portends about the institutional acceptance of this art form.
I think it's well on its way, the institutional acceptance. I mean, the Pompidou sale for me was amazing because I'm French. So it's, that has a significance. Two, it wasn't orchestrated by any collector. The curators just reached out to me and bought it, and the Pompidou paid money for it. And the Pompidou is not doesn't have the wealthiest like acquisitions budget. And so it wasn't politicking that, you know, got it in. And so that also felt really gratifying to me. And then, you know, they staged like a wonderful exhibition. And then in terms of digital art and its place, like it's happening more and more. And it's interesting because right now I'm working on some things that are physical, but I'm actually, there's another piece that's digital that's like very much at the back of my mind that I'm just excited to work on, which, you know, I've been burned by working on digital pieces that have no market in the past. And now I'm like less nervous about that. And that's amazing. And I'm also less nervous about, oh, screens are annoying. It's like, we are like the Apple Vision Pro is like gonna make collecting digital art and the kinds of digital art really different. One of the things that I loved about working in HoloLens, even though that piece was very difficult to work on, and now like the HoloLens is discontinued, et cetera, was experiencing something that, you know, we had these birds and there was a digital bird that would land on your finger in front of you while there was sound. And I thought that that experience of sound and sight close together and in 3D was really powerful and was one of the most special things about that piece, because it's not how we normally experience sound. And like when we go to a concert, things are far away, or we just see something on a screen, right? But we don't have flute and a bird landing on your finger. And now with Apple Vision Pro, I'm thinking digital art can become really intimate, close to your eyes in a way that we haven't really thought about before. So I think that digital art is going to go into all sorts of different directions. And I'm pretty excited about it. And museums are going to adapt.
Yeah, absolutely. I love that you are doubling down on digital art. And I think like we've already spoken about where you've been, and I think your resilience is incredible. You know, your breakthroughs are incredible. Like the risks that you've taken, you know, have been really powerful and have catapulted you forward. I've had the privilege and honor of like spending a lot of time with you in person. You have a really amazing aura about you. You have like really incredible energy, you know. Talk to us about what's coming up in your career, because it's not just digital. You're also doing a huge physical piece out in the desert. I'll let you speak to that. I know that you're also building custom tech and custom machinery. I won't be able to say where, but you're building it and things are happening. You have such an eclectic spirit that, yes, this is NFT now. We're talking about digital art, digital this. But this is also about pushing the boundaries of art. And I'm so privileged as your friend that you gave me this sneak peek that I'm just like so eager. Could you please share with the world like what's coming up and like what inspired those moments?
Yeah. So this machine is a very custom plotter that we started last May. Working on it at a small scale. I was seeing that some digital art was, people were making plotter drawings out of things. And I was noticing, And I was like, this is pretty interesting. And I'm seeing a bit more of it. But then I thought, well, what about not doing it with either pen or marker, which is what you see the most of, mostly because it has the pressure is, you know, the ink just comes out uniformly. Could I make a plotter that drew with pastels? And part of that is like the precision of a plotter with the messiness and the poetry and the materiality of pastels. Like pastels you think of as impressionist, right? And pastels are, they're just, pastel even colors are just, they're just so delicate and beautiful and, you know, sensitive. There's something sensitive and I like that tension usually in things, right? Cloud of Petals, it's the harsh Bell Labs, you know, industrial, and then the Rose Petals, right? So that's the tension that I like. And so we started building Clotter, then we ran into all sorts of issues that we solved over time. And I have like a full-time engineer, Kevin, who works on the plotter and on any of the other weird ideas I have, because
shout out to Kevin. Shout out to Kevin.
Making the magic happen.
because, you know, otherwise I wouldn't have time. But the prompt was pastels. And so at first we started with a small plotter. And the truth is we couldn't really get that far because the issue is that a pastel is really big and we're using it flat. So you're not getting a lot of resolution in a small area. So we switched to colored pencils just to try. We got our bearings on making a plotter with colored pencils. And then we scaled up and we built a plotter that's basically the size of a room. It's like 6 by 6 feet. And that's where we started to really be able to get resolution, because pastels just don't come that tiny. And now, you know, at first it was nervous. Like the first, when we were working at the small scale, okay, whatever. But now we're really getting results that are amazing because we're using 90 colors in a single image. And the other thing that we had to work on too is how you're turning an image into the instructions for the plotter, right? And what are the parameters that you're choosing? What are the paths? How are those paths, you know, made? What colors? How is it being separated into colors? All of those are things that we've actually tested and we run, you know, there can be a very much like an engineering approach to some of these, to trying to get these different results, right? We run a control and then different tests to see what we like. So we're really, you know, it's not just, you know, willy-nilly, but we're now getting to a point where the pastels are blending really nicely. Anyways, we'll share some pictures, but we're finally getting to a place that's really exciting. And it's interesting because it does feel like it's, you know, there's a physical manifestation, but the whole design of it is purely digital. Like we're basically turning an image into 700,000 vectors. And the question is, what colors are those vectors? And how are those vectors, you know, what paths are they taking? So it's purely, there's a strong digital component to this.
I love that. And, you know, like, speaking of strong digital components and given your background, I'm really curious to get your perspective on what has been one of the biggest stories of like the intersection of Bitcoin and art over the past year or so, the rise of ordinals. You obviously have been on this wavelength for a lot longer than many, in fact, most. What are your thoughts on ordinals and that ecosystem?
So sometimes I can be in a bit of a bubble. So I don't follow the market super closely. To me, it was just it makes sense because it does seem like at the inception when Ethereum became the chain for smart contracts and Bitcoin didn't, it was a philosophical motivation and not a technical motivation for that. And so given the success of NFTs on Ethereum, it would make sense that the Bitcoin community would sort of open their eyes and be like, hold on. We can have this too. We can do this as well. You have attaching data to all sorts of other chains. Why not Bitcoin? And so, yeah, it makes sense to me in that regard. Just, yeah, a matter of time.
That's really beautiful. Oh. I love that prescription. Outside of the things that you're doing, what's intrinsically motivating you? What's driving your curiosity these days? You've pioneered so much. Like, what's the next horizon for Sarah Mejoyas, and where is her art, or where is her currency taking her, you know?
So there are a few things. So the pastels, I'm on this journey. I want to make the most gorgeous pastels on this planet. The holograms are another sort of vertical, if you will. And the holograms, I feel very strongly about because it's a technology that doesn't have a commercial application. It really only has an application for art. It's a very technical medium, And so that means that people just don't make holograms anymore. And so it's a dying art form. So we're pretty much, you know, we're like, I'm training someone to learn because I don't want it to go to disappear. And that's not usually how technology and art intersect. Usually technology emerges for a commercial application and then artists use it, right? With digital art, all of these amazing tools were created for gaming and then artists started using it to make art. With holograms, it's the opposite. There's no commercial use case. So that's, you know, and it's, to me, it's like they're metaphysically amazing. I mean,
so you're like the piece unique of hologram arts, pretty much.
Pretty much, yeah. Especially at this level of like sort of sophistication, the holograms that we make, I mean, they're, and it's the actual recording of interference patterns of actual light waves. It's not plugged in. People use the word hologram very loosely, but this is, you know, a light hits the glass at the right angle to interact with an emulsion of silver halide particles to recreate a light wave. And so the experience of this is unlike any other experience of glass that you have.
How much physics do you know? How deep into physics did you go into?
Not much. Yeah. With all of, and that's the thing. I like working with people and, you know, pushing things to where they can go. So I'm not in the lab actually making the hologram. It's a very time consuming, intensive process, but, I care deeply about it. Right. And I know what the capabilities of the medium are. And then I'm constantly thinking about how can we push it a bit further, right? And I have technical examples of that that we don't need to go into. So there's holograms, there's the plotter, another piece that you alluded to that I proposed to Desert X, which hopefully will happen in 2025, where I was interested in caustics, which is how light plays at the bottom of a swimming pool or how light goes through a glass of water and casts light patterns on a table. And there are these scientists in Switzerland that figured out how to create an image from either something reflective or something transparent that is slightly patterned with the focal distance. So creating, yeah, images from caustics. And so we conceived of this piece where there's essentially a very large ribbon in the desert. And within each curve of the ribbon, there are these little round mirrors that the viewer has to actually articulate to get an image into focus onto the ribbon, which is kind of like a film strip. And the crazy thing about it is that we actually modeled the path of the sun on the site, so that we know exactly when things are in shadow, so that we know the angle that it's hit, that the mirror will get hit and the distance to the ribbon. And so this is all this mathematical, you know, equation to get, to be able to compute images with the sun, right? I think about like the Aztecs, right? And creating, you know, land, you know, temples and land art, et cetera, that was in relation to the sky and to looking up at the sky. And so I think about the dream of optical computing, right? So this is a first foray into land art. And it's made me think about sculpture. You know, I just want to touch all mediums. Is the truth. That's why I'm like also working on a movie and it's taken me forever. So that's the other thing, you know, sometimes it just takes me longer to work on things because I'm a newbie at it and I don't know how to do the thing. But I, you know, it's like life is short and like, I just want to, it's like experiencing all of these different mediums and understanding them is the most fun thing. So that's why I'm very unfaithful to one medium. So I just like experiencing them all.
I love that. Speaking of experiences, we've touched on Sarah, the artist, but let's talk about Sarah, the person. Like, where does she spend her time? What's her favorite book? Like, talk to us about a little bit of like what motivates you. How do you decompress from all these mathematical, rigorous, scientific, and architecturally demanding experiences that you've built?
Yeah. Well, my favorite book recently, well, I like good movies. Love good movies. There are some great movies that came out this year. The Sweet East is the most indie of them that people wouldn't have heard of.
Okay.
That I highly recommend. It's like a trip down multiple YouTube rabbit holes through like the life of a teenage girl. I mean, it's directed by a very well-known DP, and it's his directorial debut. That's my movie plug. So I like really good movies. Books, the most, the recent book that I loved was The Master Switch by Tim Wu, which is a history of technologies and media in the U.S., radio, movies, television, the internet, and how the regulatory mindset and the incumbent businesses had such a strong effect on the trajectory of each one. And reading about that interplay was amazing to me because, you know, when I'm doing the plotter stuff, you know, I'm thinking about what's the most unique visual experience, but also technically, like, where are we at that I can do this, right? And I landed on plotter because, to be honest, like, we can't do this with enough dexterity with painting yet, right? Like, the computer vision and dexterity problem is too difficult right now. But souped up plotters, like, we're there, right? We can do this now. And so thinking about, yeah, where technologies are at, and in this case, technologies for making art, but The Master Switch was an amazing book. Then I do like to do some deep tech investing, and that's just, you know, I've done investing in all sorts of areas, random areas. As you can imagine, I'm like opportunistic and just open-minded. So I've done a lot of different things, and deep tech just like appeals to me intellectually, obviously. Like, I don't really care about investing in another software company. But you know, you tell me that you're doing like 3D nanofabrication, I'm 100% interested. And so that's really fun because it's also so creative and like the discovery. And so that's another thing that I like to do. And then in terms of the rest of my life, right now I'm just, it's the most fun thing to make art. So that really does take up most of my time. And then socially, I create an event space with a partner in Tribeca. And that's a very new project. It's, you know, we installed a kitchen and we put some holograms in the bathroom and we've started hosting dinners. And the last dinner on Friday, I had 65 people and everybody sits at a really long table and you get to be seated next to your friends, but then also you meet whoever is the person next to you. And inevitably the people who attend are an intersection of my friends, of my partners, Arlie, who runs the space, of his friends, and whoever that chef for that night, their friends as well. And it feels really fun to do it because it feels kind of boring to just just go to a restaurant and sit in front of the person. You know, in college, the most fun thing was showing up at a party and you knew some people, but then you met other people. And where does that happen, right? It happens at art openings, but it can also happen in the space. And it does feel like, you know, we need these spaces. We need spaces where you just organically meet people and it's not all a chain and, you know, like, it's just, so that's my sort of social endeavor these days.
I love it. I love it. Creating that space for discovery and spontaneity and people to meet and like having that serendipity. I love it. So we have a segment that we do at each podcast called Bullish or Bearish. It's kind of like our hot take, segment. So let's start, you know, hearing that you've been working on film and have been really dabbling in the video space, given, the recent unveiling of OpenAI Sora, I'm really curious to hear your perspective, like bullish or bearish on AI video?
Bullish, so bullish. I think it's not going to completely upend Hollywood. That's not what it's going to do. It's just going to create a new type of video in the way that TikTok and YouTube didn't upend Hollywood. It just created a new type of video.
Love that. Bullish or bearish, Bitcoin hitting 100K?
Bullish.
I love it.
I know we touched on it earlier, but like given, you know, the advancements that we're seeing and how you're thinking about making your art form, like bullish or bearish on the Apple Vision Pro?
Bullish. I am bullish. Yeah. I think that the image quality is, I know it's heavy. It's too heavy. And I'm a small person, but the image quality is so good that it's going to create completely alternate visual experiences. And that's exciting.
Bullish or bearish on digital art being in traditional institutions in the next 5 years? Like the Louvre?
Bullish?
Right.
Yeah.
There it is,
Sarah. Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. Like, we had a blast with you. Thank you for sharing everything, your past, your present, and your future. And any last words, Matt?
No, just keep doing what you're doing. It's great to catch up and great to talk. And sounds like you have a lot of exciting things in the works that we can keep an eye out for.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
What a conversation, man. Like, I could have kept talking to her for another hour easily. Probably like 2 hours.
Bro. I could have been a whole afternoon, man. I was about to cancel all my meetings, you know?
I wish. What stood out to you?
Oh, man. I was just about to ask you the same thing. That's how excited I was about
jinx,
this conversation.
Jinx.
You know what I mean? You owe me a photo next time I see you. Look, I think what excited me about Sarah's work has been where she comes from. Not so much where she's going, but where she comes from. I think that natural curiosity of that omnipresent like canvas of video, holograms, technology, right? Like the curiosity of what holds value. Like that in itself was just like really powerful. And then what really stood out for me secondly from this whole perspective is just her perspective of like currency, art being a form of currency, right? And seeing that capacity. And I call it the Medici effect, right? She's so present in so many different fields that her cross-pollination makes her so unique. That plus her curiosity and her tenacity makes her really unstoppable.
Yeah, I love that. You know, one of my favorite things was when she talked about the hardships that she went through. You know, it's really easy, you know, especially, you know, artists are kind of going through it right now in the Web3 space. I know we're like, you know, precipice of a new bull market and stuff, but a lot of artists aren't feeling that, right? A lot of liquidity is dried up from the NFT space. And it's easy for some of these artists, I think, to look back at someone like Sarah, be like, oh, you were early, now you're in the Pompidou, like, you know, okay. Like, and they don't realize the struggles and the friction and the swimming against the current that it takes to be early like that, to be a pioneer like that.
6 years, right?
She went
from the fuzz of 2015 with Bitcoin to Pompidou was 2020, 2021.
Yeah, like it's wild. And you know, and when she talked about like being stuck in that dead zone, she talked about like galleries not giving her the time of day. You know, it's easy, like you always say, to look at like someone be like, oh, overnight success, whatever. That was not. That was something that was a lot of time, effort in the works and navigating some very dark and uncertain times. So I hope that anyone who is navigating times like that and listens to this podcast also finds something to resonate there. Well, look, if you did indeed enjoy this podcast, you know, we'd love to hear your feedback. Go to your podcast provider of choice. Leave us the stars. You know, we love the stars. And
we love the five stars.
We love the five stars. That's right. That's right. And also, you know, when you do leave those reviews and you do leave that positive feedback, it does help surface everything we're doing with a wider audience. And that just means more ears and more to come. So look, until next week, we will catch you again on the NFT Now podcast.